We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
This hour is brought to you by the law offices of Jeffrey M. Leving.
I have an iPad and four different screens. I don't even know where to look for the screens.
Steve Stone.
We're here, which is great.
White Sox TV analyst.
The glass is mostly full.
How do you keep your glass?
Mostly full. A rosy outlook. A positive bias.
Sorry, I'm floored. I've run out of words.
Former Cy Young Award winner.
He's my all-time favorite White Sox player.
I was a member of the Southside Hitmen in 1977, one of the most exciting White Sox teams in history.
Steve Stone.
Stoney, did you get your jelly beans replaced? I felt bad for you. Childlike excitement to enjoy your jelly beans, and now they're scattered all over the press box.
Yeah, it was pretty much an American tragedy.
You take a look at what he did last year. It wasn't overly impressive.
I did get a replacement bag. The folks at Guaranteed Rate were kind enough to drop off a bag. Granted, a smaller bag than I had, but then again, this one didn't rip, so I always look to the bright side.
Jose's going to be swinging here.
Nope, took it right down the middle.
Stoney's sitting at home saying, that's my job.
Say, you know, you don't have to win anything. Just to be nominated is a great honor. And
he was a jukebox hero, you could say.
All right, Stone Pony, thank you very much.
Breaking down the game of baseball for more than 3.5 decades.
There's 30 teams out there that could use a guy's expertise like that.
Steve Stone with Bernstein and Rahimi.
Where did your mean go? Oh, I don't know. He just dissolved.
Starts now.
Foreigner does jukebox hero.
Oh, no.
I guess he did kind of dissolve yesterday. That would explain a lot of what was going on. Steve Stone is on Twitter, at Steve Stone. The White Sox TV analyst joins us on the Alpamonte Nissan hotline. Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park at apnissan.com. Steve, how are you?
Good, Dan. How are you today?
I'll be better if somebody can explain to Tony La Russa that we now know how damaging sacrifice bunting can be and how it actually makes a team less likely to win in all but the most unique circumstances. Can somebody grab him by the lapels and tell him that?
Well, I think Tony has a certain style of managing that served him very well, and I think until he really gets to know these guys inside and out, he'll probably go with what's familiar. I think that may be the case. When I look at some of the bunting by some of the guys who bunted and some of the situations he bunted in, the one thing that jumps out just for me is I don't like to bunt ahead of the eighth and ninth hitter in the lineup. I think sometimes that's a self-defeating prophecy because the guys are hitting eighth and ninth for a reason. They normally aren't quite as good as the guys who are hitting at the top of the lineup. And so I think sometimes that becomes a bit of a waste. But, you know, look, nobody is hitting the ball. Tim took the day off. Tony said he needed a day. Today, there's some chance that the weatherman might not cooperate. So if that's the case, that would be a couple of days off. With him out of the lineup and with a whole lot of guys not even close to hitting like they can, this is an offensively challenged team. So I think the run differential is a bit deceiving in that, you know, if you're going to win your games sometimes 8-1, sometimes, you know, 10-3, and then you lose a couple that are really close, I think that the run differential looks good. It's not quite as effective, but, you know, some of the better teams have better run differentials. The Sox still have a very good one. I would like to see the offense a little more consistent, but I think that's a product more of who is not there than who is there, and who is there but not performing near to what they could or hopefully will perform.
Well, when you talk about the offense, Steve, it has been a rough week. We noted that the Sox offense, at least for 7 days in baseball, the split hasn't been good. 23rd ranked over that period of time. We know a lot of it can be attributed to Tim Anderson being in somewhat of a slump. I know he's going to break out of it at some point. Days off might help, but how do you assess the lineup so far in the past several days?
Well, look, they wrote a book about that, Layla, as you know, 7 days in May. And sometimes when that happens, you look at it as a small sample size of of a team just not getting it done. Teams are going to go up and down as far as the ability to produce some runs. And the one thing that that I look at, we've got some situations where we can run and take advantage of it. And sometimes we don't use those situations as well as I think we could. It's really funny because as aggressive as Tony is in bunting, he doesn't run in situations where I think we have the advantage. I mean, you're facing Gary Sanchez in New York. Gary Sanchez is behind the plate because he can hit. Gary Sanchez is not behind the plate because he catches it and throws it particularly well, has some problems corralling it in the dirt. I think there are certain times when if you have an advantage, that advantage is you can run a little bit. I think you really need to take advantage of that. I know it puts the pressure on the pitcher. Also, if he's thinking about a hit and run, I think that also pressures the pitcher. I think there's certain situations, especially with Nick Madrigal, who you know almost without exception is going to make contact. That would be a good way to shake up an offense. But sometimes just sitting back and waiting for three or four hits, waiting to hit the ball out of the ballpark, when your team is getting it done, that's one thing. When your team as a team is not getting it done, then that's something else. Sometimes you really have to force the action and try to put the pressure on the other team's defense. As we have seen time and time again, the defenses around baseball for the most part aren't great. I know we have one of those here in the south side of Chicago. But we also have seen a number of different defenses, notably the Cardinals. But one thing to bear in mind in that Cardinals series, coming off the sweep of the Yankees with the Cardinals in first place and having the kind of bullpen they have, if somebody would have told you, you can win two or three and not play those games, just about everybody would have taken that. Mm-hmm. That being said, when you win the first two, you get a little greedy and you want that third one. And we had infinite chances, leaving 13 base runners on. I mean, Gant is a nice pitcher and all. I know he's had a run of not letting the ball go out of the ballpark, but he was very fortunate in a lot of different areas to get out after pitching himself into trouble inning after inning with walks and a number of other things.
Your mean Mercedes left 10 runners on yesterday.
That's getting close to historic.
It actually is. We actually looked some of that up, and I don't know if Chris Kamka weighed in on it. I tried to tag him in on it, but the record was something like 16, and it was like in a 14-inning game or something like that. That means in his four plate appearances, the bases were nearly loaded. It's an average of 2.5 runners on each time he was up. He had a negative win probability added of close to 400. I mean, it's really crazy stuff. But the fact is, Major League Baseball learns things about you as a hitter relatively quickly. The data's there. And we, Layla and I went through, Layla went through the sequencing, and it looks like it's not as simple as never throw him a fastball, but it is pretty much get him at least to two strikes however you can, because then he changes his approach and that may take some of the power out of the equation, and then it's start throwing him soft stuff and breaking stuff. And that appears to be the book, and this is what baseball does.
Well, they can also, and they have done other things. If you've noticed, every time they throw him an inside fastball, and by inside, I mean 4 or 5 inches inside, he swings at that. Now he fouls it off, but he swings at that pitch. And if he puts it in play, you're not going to get very hard contact. But, you know, the league figured to adjust to your mean. And I don't say he's not going to hit, because I think he's a pretty good hitter. I think he's going to continue to hit. But we knew that he wasn't going to hit 380. I mean, we knew that was an aberration, and we were going to see that because, as you say, and it's true, the league will adjust to you. However, there's another factor that comes into play here, and that is he's hitting behind Abreu. So I don't care what he's doing. You are not in this lineup going to let Jose Abreu beat you, which puts more pressure on Yermin. Now, eventually, we're going to get back Eloy, who is the perfect guy to hit behind Abreu, because if you're going to just unintentionally, intentionally walk Abreu, Eloy is going to probably kill you. And because he's not there and Robert's not there, we still have a lot of people missing from this lineup. And so Tony's had to mix and match, find somebody behind him. At times during the course of his games, we had seen Grandal actually producing enough and being a switch hitter to hit behind Abreu. But this year, I mean, you know, he's hitting in the low ones. So that's not a whole lot of protection. I mean, if you can scare the opposing team by taking a walk and then you don't have a lot of speed, that's not a real good incentive to face Abreu. That's one of the big things. Putting somebody behind him who's swinging it well enough so that you're protecting the guy and his team paid to drive in some runs. And until either Yermin starts hitting the baseball again or they find somebody else who can get hot enough to hit behind him, Abreu's not going to see too much in those situations.
Well, and you mentioned injuries, and we saw what happened with Michael Kopech. We're waiting to find out the latest information. Mm-hmm. What was your impression of what you saw? And his absence could not just be a real downer, but bring a stressful, perhaps critical point to this bullpen and trying to figure out what to do moving forward.
Well, there's, when you look around, and one of the things you're intimating at, Layla, is, you know, coming forward, yeah, there are some candidates in the minor leagues. A lot of them are starting pitchers. And then you ask them to make the transition to the bullpen. It doesn't always go smoothly. You're seeing a couple different things in baseball, which were fairly predictable. And we talked about it early in the season. You're coming off a 60-game year, which is something we've never seen before. So coming off a 60-game year where, by the way, a lot of your young players didn't play because there were no minor leagues. Some of the players opted out, so they didn't play because you could opt out and not lose anything by it. It was predictable we'd see a lot more injuries this year. We are seeing a lot of injuries around baseball. I mean, you can take a look every day, and I watch the MLB channel and look at my computer and check on injured list, and you're seeing guys just getting hurt, going on the IL day after day after day. So it's predictable. It was predictable that it's going to happen. One of the things that bothers me is it's happening a lot with hamstrings. When Michael went down, I worried about two things. One, the first thing, I worried about a knee. I worried about him doing something with something that would have necessitated a clean out in the knee or knee surgery. Then the second thing I worried about was an ankle, which can be equally as damaging because it's either the push-out foot or the land foot, one of the two, and it's going to cause a problem for a pitcher. Actually learning that it was a mild hamstring tweak, I was very happy. Now, doesn't mean that he's going to come back any sooner than he normally would. It just means that most likely, whatever happens with the hamstring, he's going to come back and he's going to be fine. That being said, we saw an extended hamstring on the part of Adam Engel. The difference is a good part of Adam's game is speed. A good part of Michael's game is speed with throwing the baseball, but not speed and running. So I'm not near as concerned after finding the preliminary results, and now we'll hear it. But the fact that we're getting more injuries, that was very much expected, very much predictable. And then it goes to the depth of each and every one of these major league teams. I mean, you look at the Mets, they were expecting Syndergaard back. You put him with DeGrom, and you're talking about a short series with those two guys? You're in pretty good shape. They're not going to get him back. He's lost for another 4 to 6 weeks. And it happens over and over and over again. Guys, you think they're coming back and they don't. Lots of injuries this year, and it's troubling.
There's a scene in the movie The Untouchables when the character played by Sean Connery tells Elliot Ness, he says that it's not a matter of knowing where the booze is, it's who wants to cross Capone. And it's actually making the decision to make the move to wage the war. And I was mindful of that when, of all people, Joe West decides to start snatching caps that he thinks are suspicious. Mm-hmm. You turn on any game, anywhere, any team, and there's stuff all over hats, and there's stuff on batting helmets, and there's stuff on chest protectors, and there's stuff on brims of caps and backs of necks. I don't know what motivated him to do that yesterday or now what happens. You know, you and Jason were joking about the evidentiary chain of custody now. We know Trevor Bauer's suspicious balls were confiscated, and this is happening. What gives? Where does this fit in whatever MLB is doing to the best of your understanding?
Well, I feel like, was it Casablanca where they said, gambling is going on here? I'm shocked. Gambling? Not gambling. No. Anyway, look, let's take an arbitrary number for guys who are using something they shouldn't use in baseball, and let's just put it there right around 80%. So baseball knows this. Baseball has known this for quite some time. There are some innocuous folks who don't have it on their cap. Some guys have they have water on their cap, and then they reach down, get the rosin bag, and you see a light spot. It looks like almost a white or off-yellow spot on their hat. That's not necessarily anything illegal. Other guys have a dark spot on their hat, like Gallegos had yesterday. But, you know, I think for me, the hat's a little obvious. You know, sometimes you put it on a pair of your pants, and, you know, this is what my friends told me. You put it on your pants, and the umpire's not going to come out and check you. I guarantee you he's not reaching into your pants. I mean, that's just kind of the way this goes. So you can do something a whole lot better than the hat. But the result is this. If you do want to ban this, then let's not ban it, because pitchers are still going to use something. Let's get an acceptable compound sanctioned by the league and say, if you want a better grip, here's the compound. It's not going to be like Gorilla Glue where, you know, it's so stuck to your hand, you're going to get a spin rate of 5,000. And then the ball's going to be in back of your head and wind up on the outside corner. Try to hit that. Okay, so get an acceptable spin rate. Get something that allows the pitcher maybe to improve by 100 revolutions, not 300 revolutions. And then use that as an acceptable way. That's what we'll live with. And then all pitchers get a chance to do it. You don't have to be a detective each and every game to find out where it is, who's using it, how they're using it, and all of those things. Now, there's been a lot of things in baseball that they seem to accept. I don't think they want to accept this one. But I've said for a long time, you know, all of these benches clearing brawls, they're ridiculous. And the guys that get hurt are usually not the two combatants, because one of them don't want to fight. You know, when everybody clears from the, you know, you're sitting talking about what you had last night at this wonderful restaurant. Next thing you know, you're streaming out of the bullpen, running to a situation that you don't know how it started or what's happening. And you're supposedly going to back up your teammates. There's a lot of guys on the periphery get hurt in those benches clearing brawls. Baseball could do away with that tomorrow. They could do away with it with the third man in rule. I've been saying this for the last 10 years. Third man in rule, you have two combatants, you have four umpires. You have a manager, you have a coaches. You can break up those two combatants each and every time. Baseball doesn't seem to want to do that for whatever reason. You don't need guys streaming out of your bullpen. You make sure it's a fine if they do. You don't need guys coming off your bench. You make sure it's a fine if they do. You have the two guys who seem to want to get at one another. You can break them up. Easily cured. That's an easy cured one. Baseball doesn't seem to want to do it, so it continues to happen. Fans say, hey, that's kind of neat. In the meantime, sometimes you lose some guy on the periphery that was in your dugout or in your bullpen. You lose him for a couple of months. That's not too good. So again, baseball has to decide what they want to live with, what they don't, make some rules that eliminate certain things that have no use in this game. And, you know, if you don't want pitchers to cheat, then give them something they can use, because you're not going to ever just completely outlaw it, because pitchers, they're a crafty sort. They will do something like that.
Not that you would know. Stoney,
I played with a lot of guys who would use everything they could to get an advantage. And they, of course, told me, and I said, oh, au contraire, not me. I play by the rules. I'm a rules guy.
And somewhat psychic. And a good historian for me to ask you the survey of the week.
Okay.
We've been debating whether or not Yadier Molina belongs in the Hall of Fame after his career.
Yes, it's not even debatable.
Dan tries to give us a lot of fancy stats because of his offensive numbers driving everything down and doesn't seem to value the eye test here.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things that you have to realize is that if this were strictly a numbers exercise, then yeah. Talk to me about Phil Rizzuto and his numbers.
Oh, he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. He sucked.
Well, but
he's
you know,
first guy out. Oh my God, him and Frank Chance too. While you're at it,
for me and the cheap seats in the back, please explain to Dan why Yadier Molina should be in the Hall of Fame in your opinion.
Okay, here's the thing. First of all, he's amazingly gotten to hit the ball harder as he's gotten older. That's one thing, which is kind of surprising. He's also been a very good late game clutch hitter when the game's on the line, kind of thing. Also, he took himself from a guy who was inconsequential as a hitter to a guy now who you have to worry about when you're game planning. Also, there are other aspects to a catcher that might not apply for other positions. I mean, you know, you get a left fielder, if he doesn't have the numbers, well, he's a left fielder. What does he do? He occasionally hands the ball to a fan when it goes foul. He talks occasionally to the guys in the bullpen. That's about it. But a catcher is in the middle of each and every play of the game. And when a catcher is really good, and, you know, I'm not saying that Yadi is as good now as he was at blocking pitches, because he occasionally takes a pitch off or two, as he has in the last series. But for the most part, he was just mechanically outstanding. He shuts down a running game. He picks guys off. He controls what his pitchers do. He's very good at game calling. He understands and can observe hitters. I think every aspect of what a catcher means, Yadier Molina does it really well. So you have to go for him. And in that position, you have to go beyond the numbers and say, what else did he do during the course of his time? Was he the best catcher around during the course of his years? And pretty much you can say yes. As far as controlling his staff, you know, you have some guys that pitchers don't want to throw to very much. They're afraid to throw good breaking balls in the dirt with a runner at third base. That's never been the case with Yadi. I think every aspect of his game cries out to me, Hall of Famer. I think beyond a doubt. I mean, Dan, if you had to bet your house one way or the other, if you really want to live in your house and if you really like it, don't bet your house against him making the Hall of Fame.
Oh, I wouldn't.
He's getting there.
I think he will be in the Hall of Fame. I just think it's a much more difficult case than people make it out to be, because he's very similar to Ozzie Smith in that almost all of his value is defensive. Let's just play a quick game here. I know we're almost out of time, but I want to play a real quick game here.
Quick.
That using the similarity scores for baseballreference.com, the most similar players statistically, career value to Yadier Molina. I'm going to say a name, and then you give me – there is one Hall of Famer in here, and it's the number 7 similarity, Ernie Lombardi. And I'm going to take out the non-catchers in here. Orlando Cabrera is there as a non-catcher. But I'm going to start, and I'm going to go to the top to the most similar player, and you tell me, if Yadi goes in, should these similar players also be considered yes or no Hall of Famer?
I warned you.
Okay. Terry Steinbach.
Good player. Okay. I like Terry Steinbach and was on winning teams.
But not a Hall of Famer, right?
I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but you could flip a coin. He could go one way or the other.
Okay, Bill Freehan.
Don't know defensively if he was as good as Yadi. Maybe some more power that I recall. But again, you know, I didn't see a whole lot of his career, but, you know, and early Lombardi, I didn't see any of his career.
Right. And he's in. But the next up, number 6, Sherm Lawler.
Well, because of his speed, Sherm should be in. I mean, he was a Karkovice-esque as far as just foot speed was concerned. So sure, put him in.
Okay. Number 5, Jason Kendall.
Jason Kendall played an astonishing amount of games. Did he play them at a high level most of the time? I thought he was a good, solid player who was as durable as they get. He didn't his skills didn't jump out at me.
Okay, number 4, Bob Boone.
Another guy who played seemingly forever, caught more games than just about everybody. As far as being in there, you can flip a coin. That's okay. One way or the other. But he controlled the game pretty well.
Number 3, Tony Pena.
Well, tough choice. I didn't think Tony Pena was a Hall of Famer, but he was really good.
Okay, number 2, Benito Santiago.
Another one who was really good, maybe invented the drop to one knee, throw to second base play.
Yep.
At times was a terrific hitter. I think he got hurt a few times that really derailed a lot of his numbers.
And the number 1 most statistically similar player to Yadier Molina over the course of his career, A.J. Pierzynski.
Wow. Yeah, A.J. was also a phenomenally durable player, but A.J. never had what Yadi had defensively.
Nope.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't know what that lesson proved, if anything, but I just thought it was fun. Thanks for playing. We will send you a lifetime supply of Rice-A-Roni and a version of our home game.
Well, thank you. But remember one thing, Dan, and that is you have to make an exception for catchers because of the difficulty of that position, what he's involved with, how much he controls, and also because he gets hurt a lot, because he gets hit a lot, because his body takes a beating, and then you ask him to still perform offensively, there's a little latitude for me given to a catcher that wouldn't be given to other positions.
Good stuff. Stoney, thanks as always. We'll talk
next week. Take care. Bye, Layla.
Bye, Stoney. Thank you.
That's Steve Stone. We got some Cubs stuff to discuss. Some larger context here. We're asking some tough questions about where this team is right now and what they're proving they may deserve. That's next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Peterson takes a breaking ball low and in. The umpire, Doug Eddings, wanted no part of that ball.
He was bailing quick.
Yeah, he saw that hit the dirt in front of the plate, and he said, I know it's not going to be a strike, so I'll see you later.
And now David Ross taking that time to get all over Doug Eddings about hanging in there on that pitch in the dirt, and Doug Eddings saying, I want no part of that.
Careful, Rossi. He might run you if he misinterprets what you're saying.
Happy birthday to Pat Hughes. Love that. Nice to hear him and Ron Coomer on the call. We've got Cubs pregame at 11. We said we were going to be like zippy and efficient today.
No,
we lied to you.
It's bad. But think about this, though. Like,
we're technically supposed to take a break in a minute.
I know. But the Cubs are making a case for bolstering their team at the deadline right now. I know they'll know at the end of June, or they'll know that there's a lot of baseball to come. But when you really start looking at how this is shaping up, this could be whatever transition they talked about, this sort of defiant narrative. They go, we'll show you. You're not talking contract extension with us. We're still here and we're still playing and we'll show you how good we are. And maybe there's a little bit of that. Maybe it's kind of living in the moment, like Ian Happ has said and like Chris Bryant has said. They can only play that next day and they are enjoying each other's company and they understand this might be the last roundup. But do you think that Jed Hoyer really goes to Tom Ricketts and says, can we have another pitcher?
After I traded away Yu Darvish.
Right. After you made me trade away Yu Darvish because you didn't want to pay him because you like money.
Thereby making the NL West better because the Dodgers knew they had to do even more to maintain their championship. Mm-hmm. That one's going to stick with me a while. Here's the other concern about this is that, you know, all those times when they were like, hey, water's going to find its level. These dudes are going to hit. It's here. It's here. We can't even enjoy it. We don't know what to do with it. They're 15-7 this month. They're now beating the teams they're supposed to beat. And Trevor Williams had an amazing game.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what looked different other than just the outcomes of the pitches. What maybe they saw about his delivery in pitch lab. Something looked different to me, but I haven't done like the Jeff Sullivan side-by-side stuff.
We need Sahada to dial it up again because he had that brilliant article about it before the season began.
I need Jeff Sullivan on Fangraphs again instead of working for the Tampa Bay Rays when he used to notice something in a delivery and give you the full breakdown on Fangraphs, but now he's working for a team, so we don't get it.
Well, Kevin Goldstein's back from being a made man, so he's a master of services, so maybe we can ask him to do this for us. But the bottom line is, Trevor Williams was the dude the Cubs wanted him to be last night, and he had two hits. Like, just add that to the total while we're at it. But the observations that were made from players about how the ball coming out of his hand looked more, let's say it again today, efficient and zippy at 91. And that it was crisp, he was working quickly, and it was keeping hitters off balance. That's exactly what you want him to do. So wait a second. The hitting is now hitting and the pitching is now pitching. What do we do with our hands?
That's what I wonder. As long as you don't do the two hands over the face, that we know we're probably in a better place then.
If Surrender Cobra is this, then what is two hands over the face? That's general dismay?
Yeah, because that's your go-to move when something is just overwhelmingly bad, generally.
Bears quarterback talk.
But I guess you have to treat this as real unless you white flag it.
It's real!
Unless you start talking about whatever the 96 White Sox or whatever it was when they decided, you know, we're close, but we're not going to win anything. We have Craig Kimbrell and Chris Bryant and Javier Baez and Wilson Contreras, and let's just tear it down for parts. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think we have to consider the possibility that the very same owners that were just tired of paying Yu Darvish might get tired of paying everybody.
Do you think that's the speech? Yeah, we just got tired of paying people.
Well, that's what it
is. Hey, the money problems are solved. Taco Bell is back.
They don't own Taco Bell, though.
I don't care. Somehow this is a good thing. I don't know what you do. That's the problem. I don't know what you do because Chris Bryant is still producing. He was 3 for 5 yesterday. The rest of the lineup wasn't as productive, but it doesn't matter. You don't need everybody to be at all times. You just need the dudes you expect to do things, and then that's kind of how it comes together.
Or the guys you don't expect to do things. I mean, you had before
Sogard with 2 hits.
Before he got hurt, Jake Marisnyk was one of the few guys producing for you. And today, if you haven't seen the lineup, after Contreras, Bryant, Baez, Happ, and Bodie, Ortega is in left, Wisdom is in right, and Sogard is at second.
Wisdom. I mean, you gotta like the name.
We had a friend in college who, and I didn't know his actual name until like senior year, but everybody called him Freedom. And I don't know how he got the nickname Freedom. It was a great nickname. And that's just who he was just Freedom. And I found out when we graduated, his name was Jeff.
And to people who are pointing out that it's the Pirates, they also beat the division leader in St. Louis. They also swept the Dodgers and they swept the Mets when the Mets had dudes and Cameron Maybin wasn't in that lineup. No offense to Cameron Maybin. It's just a good picture of what's happening there.
He wanted to go play for the Mets because the Mets were out of guys and they needed a guy and they traded him for $1.
$1.
There must be transactional consideration, so they got $1.
Price is right.
Yeah, that's about what he's been lately, but hey, he wants to go, and he was betting in the 3-hole. It tells you about what their lineup is.
That's the Mets baseball I know and love. This functional Mets baseball, water finding its level again.
And speaking of which, when we talk about the Trevor Williams and the Mets, the best observer of the Mets, as always, in many things, is David Roth of Defector. And when I saw Trevor Williams last night...
I loved him with Van Halen.
I tweeted David Roth, one of really the smartest writers of anything, and the heir to David Foster Wallace in a lot of ways with his observational skill and intellect. And he had a whole thing in the mid-2010s about wet guy. That every baseball team had a wet guy.
That's gross.
Who was usually a starting pitcher. Do you remember Clay Buchholz?
Yes.
And like the stringy hair. Mullet. And like, yeah, like, and wet. Like always like that. And he was always tracking across the league the popularity of wet guy. So I tweeted him and I said,
known more for his curveball, but go on.
And I said, look at Trevor Williams. And I said, isn't this total throwback wet guy? And he said, absolutely. He said it's vintage, looking like he just fell off a shrimp boat. he's right out of like 2015. And if it helps him pitch, if it helps him play like that, then good on him. We're going to do the Midday Midway as our final segment. I have a fish that I didn't know existed, and I want to fish for it and catch it and enjoy it immediately.
Well, we've clearly been working together for too long because mine is about a guy texting an aquarium drunk.
Awesome. Fish stories next on The Score.
You were a part of that tonight. Can you just talk a little bit about your offensive performance here?
I blacked out twice.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
1-2.
Midway, the most important of the year.
3-4.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
5-6-7-8.
Our objective is Midway.
9-10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
It's not really the Midway, as it's going to be our final segment before Cubs pregame, but we thought we'd do it anyway because we like it and it's fun. We talked a lot of baseball and bunting and Loretta's Lounge and Steve Stone and Cubs.
And Stoney telling you Yadier Molina belongs in the Hall of Fame.
He'll be in. I have a little more stringent standard than many.
Your numbers have no use here. So, South Carolina Aquarium has an Ask an Aquarium Educator number, so you can learn stuff. Somebody got drunk and started texting it. And here are the questions. I'm currently at the corner of Market and Meeting. What would I have seen around me 10,000 years ago before the area was settled by humans? I like a pleasant drunk. This
good question.
Funny. So there are apparently answers to all of these questions, but they didn't publish them. So let's hear what the questions are. Also, when was the area first settled? Don't know that that's an aquarium question, really. Is there something unique to the Lowcountry that those who study marine life are fascinated by? On which subjects do marine biologists disagree? There must be things generally agreed upon, but what theories are currently being debated? This is my fave. Also, why do seahorses grab anything they can with their prehensile tail?
That is a good question. These are all good questions.
Why should I only eat oysters in months that contain the letter R? Man, that's not an aquarium question. That's just a taste question. Don't get gross. And then the automatic reply was one of them, where they showed it. It's on their Twitter account. Hi, thank you for all of your questions. 10,000 years ago, South Carolina would have seen the end of an ice age. And I really want to know more of the answers, but they had a couple of them. Here's one. Seahorses like to use their tails to hold on because they aren't very good swimmers, and they may get tossed around in currents if they aren't holding on. Aww. Aww. As for oysters, this rule comes from the fact that bacteria that is harmful to humans is more likely to be present during the warmer seasons that do not end with an R. Well, what do you know? I just think they taste weird. Waiting for the months to end with an R also allow for spat, that's baby oysters, to reach an appropriate size and for populations to recover before harvest. That's important.
Yeah, eat cultivated oysters, too.
And then his reply was, thank you so much for all of your answers. My wife should be happy I drunk text aquariums and not other women. I love this guy.
A Texas angler and bass guide didn't expect to make history when he set out in the water in March, but he has. Wyatt Frankens reeled in an unusual fish weighing 7.6 pounds on the OHIV Reservoir. He reached out to state biologists to identify the bass, and the results are in. It is a mean mouth bass. It is an idealized hybrid of smallmouth and largemouth. That means the size of a largemouth fighting with the ferocity of a smallmouth. It's the best of all things. Because those of us who know that pound for pound in fresh water, I mean, I know I've had some experience with lake trout throwing out my shoulder, but pound for pound, there is no more exciting animal for sport fishing than a smallmouth bass. Yet they don't get as big as largemouth. This thing, holy crap. Like, I wanted to get on a plane and go hire this guy and take me out for multiple day trips just chasing these on this reservoir.
Where? What reservoir?
It's the OHIV.
OHIV.
Reservoir. And it's called a mean mouth bass, and it was called that because this man-made hybrid, it was extremely aggressive. That means
he is aggressive.
Nasty when it hooks up, and this is a all-line class world record for Wyatt Frankens. But man, if they can find a way to find these things and find a way to make them proliferate, and if this becomes a sustainable hybrid, bring it on, because that's perfect.
How do you feel about flying into San Angelo? Because that's the nearest hub.
Don't know where it is.
Exactly.
Anyway, that does it for us. Thank you so much. Thanks to everybody, Brian and Connor and Jay and Jordan and Steve Stone for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow. We have Cubs baseball that is straight ahead on the score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.